WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After covering terrorist attacks in the Middle East and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, my guest Charles Sennett has been covering the terrorist attacks in London. He's London bureau chief and a foreign correspondent for the Boston Globe and was formerly the Globe's Jerusalem bureau chief. He's about to return to Boston with his wife and four children, where he will spend the next academic year as a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. He intends to study and write about the contemporary history of religious fundamentalism in the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim faiths, and examine the role religion is playing in shaping the news from Washington to the West Bank. This morning, Sennett went to a studio in London to talk with us about last week's terrorist attacks and their aftermath. I asked him to compare how Americans reacted to September 11th with how the English reacted to July 7th.
I think there are a lot of differences. I think there are more differences than there are similarities. But I think the first thing in terms of the differences is that September 11th was really a qualitatively different event. I mean, this was many more people killed. This was a direct attack on one of these huge symbols of America, of capitalism, of the Twin Towers reaching up into the sky. The July 7th attacks were smaller in scale, which is important, and also they were attacks deep down in the tunnels of the underground. And I think those two kind of physical aspects of the attack are really important to point out. When September 11th happened in New York City, you know, America was completely shocked. It was left asking this question we heard over and over again, why do they hate us? In London, on July 7th, this was totally different. This was a nation filled with dread and some kind of grim expectation. And I think the operative question here among Londoners was, why did this take so long? And it's very interesting that the two mayors of this city even kind of seem to represent and embody the differences in these two responses to the attack and these two different understandings of the attack. You know, in New York, Mayor Giuliani emerged, the tough prosecutor, greatly admired as someone who spoke out forcefully, stood on the rubble, bound the city together in its resolve to fight terrorism. And the mayor here, Ken Livingston, couldn't be more different. He's known as Red Ken. And his response has been this very subdued response. He's quietly commuting on the underground to work. He's saying the city will go on. We're not going to let a few criminals, and he didn't call them terrorists. He said a few criminals to change our way of life. And I think in those two mayors, if you bring it up to the national level, you also had a different response in America. With September 11th was a very military response, swift, firm, to go at the source of this and to go right into Afghanistan with airstrikes and with special forces. Here, the response is much more a police response. It's much more a kind of sense of perspective that this country survived the Blitz. It's lived through a generation of a bombing campaign by the IRA in London. The response is one in which they want to bring criminals to justice.
For President Bush, September 11th was a defining moment. The nation seemed to rally behind him. He developed a military policy to try to deal with terrorism. And the war has become increasingly unpopular in the United States. But for Prime Minister Tony Blair, how are the attacks of last week in London affecting his popularity and affecting, you know, how he's seen?
Well, for now, what we see is a real strong sense of resilience. And I think there's a great solidarity right now. We're not hearing anyone yet criticizing Tony Blair about his bringing the country to a very unpopular war in Iraq and how that has perhaps created the conditions in which London has now been targeted. You hear it on talk radio a little bit. It's not a lot. I think there's a certain amount of kind of British decency here. You know, I think they're saying that they're going to first, they're angry. Now they are talking about how they're going to respond, and there's a calm resolve to it. And I think eventually down the road, after the kind of national mourning is over, after there have been funerals, I think you will hear a lot of talk about how this bombing is a result of Britain's support for the U.S.-led war in Iraq. You can almost hear the responsible voices holding back on saying that. But you can hear some kind of renegade members of parliament like George Galloway, who have already begun to say it, who've already said that this is, you know, a sense of London reaping what it sows. And that has been hugely controversial here. I do think we're going to hear a lot more about that in the near future. And I think that unlike the way in which America has kind of trusted its leadership and said, you know, we as a country, I think there's a general consensus. I could be wrong about this, but I do think there is a general consensus that they want to see the U.S. government and its military go after those who are seen in America as the perpetrators of this event, whether that's in Afghanistan or Iraq or beyond. Here, I think there's a sense that the war in Iraq has very little to do with the struggle against terrorism, and that it may, in fact, undercut efforts to fight terrorism, and that it may, in fact, be inflaming the situation, making the world less safe. And I think we will continue to hear that voice come out of the United Kingdom. And I think Blair's political pressure that's been imposed upon him will remain there even after this attack.
You were at the G8 summit when London was attacked. How did you first hear about the bombings?
Well, in spirit of a beautiful morning of great confidence and excitement in London, I was driving from Edinburgh towards Gleneagles when two other colleagues from major newspapers, I won't give their names, decided it might be a great idea if we stole a few hours to go fishing.
Oh, no.
And we pulled into a little tiny lake where there was a beautiful fishing lodge, old stone, and we kind of looked at our watches and we said, you know, we're really early. We're really on this. We'll rent some rods. Let's do it. And just as we were moving on that, you know, we began to hear about the bombs being, quote, power surges. And none of us really bought that, especially with the reports of three explosions. And, of course, that moment of a wonderful sunny morning of great optimism where we thought we could steal a few hours before we came back and wrote that lead story about how great the world leaders are in terms of addressing this issue of poverty and AIDS in Africa. And of course, all of it changed. And all of that horribly depressing, dark stuff that so many of us have been covering all over the world, whether it's in Jerusalem, New York City, Madrid, London, we were back on that story. And that was a very depressing moment.
Your wife and children were in London while you were at Gleneagles. You've been through these kinds of attacks before. You served as the Middle East bureau chief, the Jerusalem bureau chief for the Boston Globe. Did you have a plan, a strategy already in place about what to do when there was a terrorist attack and you were separated from your family covering a story?
Well, there is, you know, very sadly, this grim familiarity to this for us as a family. We know it's kind of like you go into auto drive. And this would be true of any correspondents who've been based in Jerusalem or any families who are Israeli or who are Palestinian, for that matter, who live in these conflict zones, that when bad things happen, the first thing you do is you get on the phone and, of course, have to be very patient because all of the phone lines go down. So you have to keep dialing. I think I had you know, at least 50 attempts before I got through to my wife to find out things are okay, she's okay. And we both remarked to each other that, you know, here we are again, checking on each other for another bombing incident in another city where we're living. And it feels these days increasingly like the whole world is Jerusalem, like the whole world is experiencing this sense of dread of when is the next bomb.
What are some of the things you think we can learn from how Israel has dealt with terrorist attacks in terms of things you think they've done right and things you think they've done wrong?
Well, I think there are things that each country can learn from the other. I think that what America can learn from Israel, and some of the lessons are positive. We can learn a lot of good things from them, and some of them are very negative. I think that we don't want to mirror some of the mistakes they've made. The good things are a resilience. When you cover a bombing in Jerusalem, it is amazing how quickly the shop owners have swept up the glass, how quickly the place gets back to normal, how the people will not allow terrorism to change their daily lives. There is a great determination and resolve to that, a courage that is admirable. I think on intelligence terms, the Israelis understand who is who within these terrorist structures, but I don't think they've asked enough questions about why are they so angry. I don't think there's enough intense examination of the actual source of the despair, the disaffection, and what can quickly be transformed into hatred in these pockets of despair, of a sense of double standards of different policies in the Middle East between the way the West deals with Israel or the way it deals with other allies in the Middle East. And I think that self-examination of those harder questions is something that we in America should be doing more of, because it, frankly, you know, I think there's a perspective among a lot of people within Israel itself that Israel didn't do enough of that. And it's kind of more blunt military response to terrorism, reoccupying land, going in with tanks, taking it on as a military operation to defeat terrorism, really is a mistake. It's a misguided policy among most of the counterterrorism experts who I talk to. They see it as a failed approach to a problem, that if you greet terrorists with tanks, then they win, inevitably, because you've dragged your country into a war which is a completely unequal conflict, and they're going to win every time that way. I think there is something very healthy in the way the British have approached this as very much a criminal investigation, very much looking at it as something that needs to be a matter of law and order, people brought to justice, and an investigation in which they will rely on their excellent security services to figure this out.
How would you compare how the U.S. and the U.K. has dealt with extremists and has dealt with that balance between surveillance and civil liberties?
Both places are struggling with that balance. It is the most difficult balance for an open democratic society in this new modern struggle against terrorism that we're facing. I think both are succeeding and failing in different ways. I think in the United States, the approach is very much more prosecutorial. They are looking to investigate these cells to result in prosecutions. In doing that, they have carried out this policy of extraordinary rendition, which is extremely controversial over here in Europe. It is viewed as illegal, unjust, wrong, and they don't want to have any part of it. We saw this glimpse of this in Milan, remember, where the CIA operatives picked up the suspect off the street, a militant Islamic cleric, and have done this version of extraordinary rendition, which is a very polite word for a snatch-and-grab operation. The idea is that they pick them up off the street, and then they export them to a different country, many of those countries using torture to extract information. That in Europe is viewed as way beyond the line, and America is being greatly criticized for that in Europe. We saw this in Italy because they have actually issued arrest warrants for those CIA officers, and the government has claimed that it did not approve this operation. The CIA has claimed that it did seek approval. It hasn't really gotten back to us on whether or not it got approval for that operation. For the British, I think it's a strategy of what's called disruption. The British approach it very differently. They're trying to keep very close surveillance through a lot of wiretaps on phones, using a lot of informants. And it's a strategy they used with the IRA, and that is to stay very close to the pulse and then go in and disrupt the cell before it can carry out a bombing. The problem with that approach is you don't end up in prosecution. The British have had 700 people arrested under counterterrorism laws since September 11th. And only 17 convictions. So what they're doing is basically rounding people up who they think might be about to act or might be involved with a group that is about to act, as a way to say, we're here, we know what you're doing, and to disrupt the bombing. And that has also been sharply criticized by civil rights organizations here.
My guest is Charles Sennett, London bureau chief of the Boston Globe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the terrorist attacks in London with Charles Sennett, the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and former Jerusalem bureau chief. London is considered to have become something of a center for Islamic extremists. What's behind that? How did London become a center?
Well, London has always been one of the great crossroads of the world, and that would be true for Muslims of the world. I mean, there are so many people from Pakistan here and from Iraq and from Afghanistan. It has very lax asylum laws. It welcomes those who are seeking refuge from political persecution in their home countries. That's one reason it's brought these people here. Another reason is it's a grappling hook for immigrants. And so, you know, when you have communities who are Iraqi or Moroccan or Afghani or Pakistani, they begin to coalesce around neighborhoods and mosques, and they are very much an immigrant community that is a very lively, vibrant part of London, one of the great parts of London. You know, that you have this sprawling Muslim community that's full of wonderful, hardworking, decent people. But in some very dark corners of that community, there are mosques where Islamic militant sheikhs, like this legendary one, Abu Hamza — this is the guy with the one eye and the hook for a hand — who became a symbol of this idea that there really is a hotbed of Islamic militancy in London. He took over a mosque called the Finsbury Park Mosque. The Finsbury Park Mosque was literally physically taken over from that vast majority of moderate Muslims who don't want anything to do with these guys. Through fear and intimidation, they bullied their way into the mosque. And for several years, he preached openly about a call for jihad.
Well, the cleric from the Finsbury Mosque is in prison now, and the mosque is now a moderate mosque again. Have you been to any of the more militant mosques in London?
I have. I've spent a fair amount of time at Finsbury Park, and watching that process that you pointed out of seeing the moderates reclaim their mosque is something really encouraging. It really speaks to where the war on terror, I would put that in quotes, needs to go, which is to enlist the vast majority of Muslims who want absolutely nothing to do with this tarnishing of their faith. They are, in fact, so angry about it that we're seeing, finally, and a bit late, to be honest, them stirring and reacting to this and really coalescing, coming together to speak out, to reclaim their faith as they see it, to take it back from those who want to carry out violence, killing of innocent people in the name of Islam. And that is where I think the true battle of terrorism needs to go. And I think that's where you really begin to see change. So as much as Finsbury Park is this depressing symbol of the hotbed of Islamic militancy that London has become in many ways, it's also a great example of what can happen when the majority of Muslims reclaim their faith.
Well, how was the mosque reclaimed, so to speak?
It's an interesting story because it happens on two levels. One is the police raid it. And interestingly, that police raid was very unpopular among the entire Muslim population. They felt that it was going too far, that it was a Rambo-like move. And in a way, it was the police raid to arrest Abu Hamza, that sort of sparked the confidence in the moderates to come in and take it over, to say, hey, it's not the police operation we want here. We want people power. We want people to come in and reclaim this mosque. And I've talked to some of the people who were involved in that process, and this was quite literally a physical confrontation. They had to go in, and those who had surrounded Abu Hamza, who were very much Islamic militants, who openly speak of the attacks of September 11th as, quote, self-defense, who have called many of the bombers who carried it out heroes. These are people who have a deep hatred for the West, and they physically went after them. They pushed them out of the building. They reclaimed it physically. And it was a pretty heroic act that kind of went by quite quietly on the streets of London.
You've also been to mosques in the Middle East, haven't you? Radical mosques?
I have. I mean, I've met with Sheikh Yassin of Hamas. I've met with Nasrallah of Hezbollah. And I think all of us who've covered the Middle East find ourselves in these places through our years of reporting on this unfolding story of Islamic militancy and where it's coming from. We've all had a chance to talk with them, to hear their grievances. And I've also had a chance to put it directly to them about the killing of innocent people and how could that possibly be justified in the name of Islam. And I, you know, you never get a very good answer, frankly, because it isn't justified within the within the tenets of that faith. But what they will completely turn to almost every time is that the innocent killing of Palestinians is happening every day in Israel. The innocent killing of Iraqis is happening every day at the hands of U.S. troops. So it's very much a sense not of the essence of Islam, but more the very blunt, ancient, rigid message of the Hebrew Bible, of the Old Testament, of an eye for an eye.
Charles Sennett is the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and former Jerusalem bureau chief. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Charles Sennett, the Boston Globe's London bureau chief and former Jerusalem bureau chief. He also covered the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq for the Globe. You're packed and will soon be leaving your home in London to come back to Boston. You're going to take some time off from reporting for the newspaper to be a Nieman Fellow. This is a journalism fellowship. And while you have this fellowship, you're going to be researching how fundamentalisms, Islamic, Christian, and Jewish, have been affecting world politics and life in the world. Why have you chosen that subject, and why are you looking at all three religions?
Well, I'm just so drawn to this subject because it is shaping every news event I cover. I think that this turn towards fundamentalism in this part of our timeline in history, you know, the end of the last century and the beginning of this century, is very much one of the great events that is happening in the world. And I think we as journalists, we report on it all the time, but I don't think we understand it. I don't think we hear the music of religion enough. I don't think we know the texts well enough. I want to become familiar with all of the texts, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, so that I can speak on some surer footing with people who are headed towards this militancy, because I think we in the media fail almost every time in understanding deeply these faith communities, what they mean, and how there are these very wayward elements, fringe elements that are going in such wrong directions, and how we need to be much smarter about challenging them, asking them the hard questions. And I think the only way I'll be able to do that is to back up, to study, to deepen my knowledge of those faiths, and then come back at it as a reporter.
You will soon be coming back to Boston. What are the things you're looking forward to or not looking forward to about coming back to the States?
Well, like any Bostonian, I am returning to the true Holy Land, which is Fenway Park, right? Fenway Park is the thing I have longed for the most. Also, fishing off Waisqui Point and just the feeling of being home. I really feel strongly and warmly about getting home to family and friends and colleagues and reconnecting with America. I have to be honest that I also have a sense of dread about how much America has changed. And I keep hearing that from friends back home, that I'm not going to be prepared for the ways in which the country has changed.
Just one more thing. Although you haven't lived in America for about 9 years, you certainly know media coverage in America very well. You know the television and newspaper reporting, although things have changed a bit in those 9 years. But how would you compare the media coverage of the terrorist attacks in London last week with what you've come to expect of American media coverage of attacks?
I think the British coverage has been very cautious. They've been very unwilling to go into the realm of speculation. And it's an interesting caution for a newspaper industry that has very little caution on other issues. And I've been impressed with the sense of going slow, being right, And I see the American coverage of the attacks on London as maybe a little bit over the top in the way that we're approaching it, in the way we're quoting Rudy Giuliani, who came here to visit, about this is, you know, a country that survived the Blitz. This is, you know, this sense of comparing it to World War II, I see more in the American press than I do in the British press. And I think we've been criticized, in fact, today in The Guardian, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, the LA Times, were criticized for talking about this hotbed of Islamic militancy and not giving a fair enough context of the greater Muslim community here. And I think that's a fair criticism. I think too often the larger context of the Muslim communities gets trimmed out, or we don't have the space, or there's no kind of conspiracy behind it. It's sort of the machinery of our industry that we don't provide enough context. But I think it was a fair criticism. The Guardian really stung us a bit today. And I think we should listen to that, and we should reflect on it, and we should try to do better to be sure we capture not just that little Islamic militant mosque, but an understanding of the larger Muslim community and the grievances that it feels about U.S. policy in the Middle East without painting them all as potential militants. Many of them are just hardworking, successful people who are thinking about things in the world and want to voice their criticism of U.S. policy.
Well, I wish you a good move back to Boston. Charles Sennett, it's been a pleasure to talk with you again, always is, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Charles Sennett spoke to us from a studio in London. Our interview was recorded this morning. He's the Boston Globe's London Bureau Chief and former Jerusalem Bureau Chief.